Thanks, Innocent. Thanks very much to the AI Group for the opportunity to come to speak to you today. It is great to be in Geelong. I'm the daughter of a diehard Geelong fan, so it's really nice to be here. And it has been a big week for the bank in Victoria, with the board meeting in Melbourne on Tuesday and the Governor's speech there that evening. Now, I don't plan to repeat what he said or speak in detail about the board's decision today. We've already written quite a bit about that. Rather, what I'd like to do is take a step back and talk about some of the aspects of how the bank's economics team understand and interpret economic developments so that we can do the analysis that's important as an input into the board's decisions. Now, most of our job is interpreting the recent data and using that to forecast the future. And we lean heavily on our intellectual frameworks in economics for thinking about how economies work. But we also need to account for an array of special factors and big picture trends that don't sit neatly in top-down whole economy models, such as standard economic forecasting models. So today, I'd like to talk about how we handle special factors in our understanding of the economy, and I'll also give some examples of the kinds of factors that have been especially relevant of late. So how do we know if there's a special factor at play? One source of information is via our liaison teams around the country, including in Melbourne. They meet with all sorts of organisations and groups to better understand these special factors and trends. In many cases, the story behind the numbers is as important as the numbers. The AI Group and many of its members have been generous partners in our liaison program for many years, and we truly appreciate your insights into those stories. Now, if you're facing some special factor in the economy, how do you make sense of it? You can get the story behind the numbers from the players on the ground, but how do you incorporate those insights into your view of the overall economic outlook? Well, I'd argue that it helps to look at the basic shape of that special factor so that you can form a view about how it will play out. Informally put, you need to work out if what you're looking at is a lump, a bump, or a wave. A lump is when a single firm, industry, or product has a discernible outsized effect on overall outcomes. Some recent examples include the effect of the Victorian Nurses Pay Equity Agreement on overall public sector wages growth, or perhaps individual projects having an effect on aggregate mining investment. Bumps are the factors that we can't really model or don't typically model that push economic outcomes around temporarily. So you can think of examples like the drought and the effect that that has on rural exports and food prices, or the effect of Cyclone Veronica on Australia's iron ore exports. Waves, by contrast, are those long-lasting, often structural forces that take the economy to a new state. And you can think of examples like technological change, climate change, and demographic change. Now, those are just very simple, non-technical descriptions. I am not suggesting that lumps, bumps, and waves is a new technical taxonomy you should all adopt. But it does show you why it's useful to know something about the underlying shape of a particular special factor. If something is a lump or a bump, it doesn't mark the beginning of a change in trend. Its effects may not last. In developing our forecasts or setting monetary policy, we might want to look through those lumps and bumps and focus instead on the longer-term trends. On the other hand, if it's a wave, it might represent a change in trend. Often, the economy needs to transition to that new trend or new normal. It might not be obvious exactly where that new endpoint is or how long that transition will last. This is very different from a lump or a bump, where things can be expected to revert to previous norms fairly quickly. Lumps, bumps, and waves also differ in how well they can be anticipated and quantified. A lump comes from a single industry, firm, product, or policy having an outsized effect on the total, and often these effects can be anticipated. In particular, if they came from a policy change, they're often pre-announced. For the same reason, they can usually also be quantified, or at least approximately. Bumps can be a bit trickier. By their nature, they're often impossible to anticipate. After all, who could have predicted the dam collapse at an iron ore mine in Brazil or the more recent drone attacks on Saudi oil processing facilities? Certainly not central bank economists. And although some aspects of their effects can be quantified, the production loss, for example, the effect on prices or the subsequent effect on behaviour can be harder to assess. The waves are in many ways the hardest. By definition, they persist for some time, so you know you need to take them into account in your view of the outlook, even if you didn't anticipate their beginnings. But because they have such pervasive effects, it's often unclear exactly how to take them into account. Now, lumps and bumps are, in some sense, both noise. In principle, noise should wash out of the total figures. But in real-world economies, it doesn't. Like pop songs or movies, where a few blockbuster hits far outshadow the long tail of minor releases, industries and economies often follow something like a power law, with a large number of small entities and a small number of very large ones. This kind of structure is probably more prominent in a country like Australia than a larger, more diverse economy like the United States. What's important, though, is that idiosyncratic shocks to a large entity can be enough to affect the total, on its own or by propagating to other entities. When thinking about how these lumps and bumps affect the economy and our forecasts, it's important to consider what the bounce back looks like. We need to ask, is this a shock to the level or to the growth rate? Consider the case where a natural disaster or some other event disrupts production at a particular facility. When things return to normal, is there a period of catch-up where production is temporarily higher than normal? Or does production just revert to the previous normal level, in which case the production that would otherwise have occurred in the disrupted period is simply lost? Or is the effect on production levels more permanent, so that the growth rate returns to normal, but the level of production now follows a persistently lower trend track? These are the things we have to disentangle. And these lumps and bumps can affect how you interpret the data, and they're not always about natural disasters. So one recent example can be seen in public sector wages growth. The bank has for some time been noting that government wages policies are restraining wages growth in the public sector. In some cases, these policies also apply to workers in the private sector doing work on behalf of governments, such as on construction projects or in parts of the health sector. So it might have been thought a little surprising that public sector wages growth actually picked up noticeably in the June quarter of this year. But this wasn't a surprise. It was a fully anticipated lump. A long-standing agreement to bring wages of Victorian nurses and midwives in line with those in New South Wales accounted for essentially all of this pickup in the growth rate. And because it is an adjustment to the wage level, we expect the rate of wages growth to fall back to its recent averages in subsequent quarters. Now, a lump like this is relatively easy to anticipate and incorporate into your analysis, as long as you know it's happening. I mean, this isn't always feasible. Sometimes lumps, such as large investment projects or certain wage deals, are not public information, or at least not until after they've happened. By contrast, natural disasters are the canonical example of bumps that you can't fully predict, but you can anticipate as a possibility, and it's obvious when they've happened. The effect of the drought on rural production and food prices is a good example of this. So were the two recent disasters affecting the iron ore market. The early months of the year are cyclone season in the Pilbara, so some disruptions to production can be reasonably anticipated, and indeed they get adjusted out of the seasonally adjusted data. But Cyclone Veronica was far more disruptive than most, and together with the Brazilian mine disaster, this greatly reduced supply into the seaborne market for iron ore. Because iron ore is such an important export for Australia, export revenue, the terms of trade and fiscal revenue all increased noticeably. And yes, this means that some things didn't turn out as we had forecast. Weather-related and other disasters aren't the only cause of bumps, of course. Sometimes people's actions are the root cause. These can be as prosaic as maintenance schedules that affect shipments of exports, or as alarming as the recent attacks on Saudi oil facilities. The impact of these events depends on how sustained the effect on production and prices will be. Now, higher oil prices flow through fairly directly to petrol prices and thus generate short-term fluctuations in CPI and inflation, both here and abroad. The broader implications depend on how strong global demand might be, how quickly production can be restored, and on how easily replacement sources of supply can ramp up. In the case of the recent attacks, it seems that Saudi supply has been mostly restored already. So the effect on prices has been small and transient. But it is easy to see how these kinds of events can have more pervasive effects. Now we come to the big waves, maybe not on the bay here, but certainly in the economy. The secular trends or transitions to new states of the world. These might be easy to identify and name, but they're often hard to anticipate. And their effects can be pervasive and hard to disentangle. It's also easy to be struck by just how many waves there are and how diverse their causes can be. Many of these waves come from causes that are in some sense outside the economic system. Demographic forces are perhaps the best known of these. Because these forces play out over long periods, they're usually thought of as being outside the system, though of course policy can affect demography to some extent. The rise of China and its wave of urbanisation is a good example where policy and underlying demography have both mattered. With that urbanisation has come a lot of housing and infrastructure construction. This in turn has increased demand for steel and related commodity prices, with profound effects on the world economy and especially Australia. Perhaps the best example here, though, is the demographic shift that is the ageing of the population. This is something the bank has talked about publicly in recent years, and it has been a priority of the Japanese presidency this year in the G20. Today, I'd like to highlight the implications of population ageing for labour force participation. It's often assumed that population ageing will reduce participation because more people will be elderly and thus retired. But in Australia, the opposite has happened. This is also true for other advanced economies, with the United States being the exception. Although there are more older people, and older people do tend to participate less in the labour force than people in their middle years, participation rates in both age groups has increased enough to more than offset this. Older people have increased their participation, and so have women across many age groups. Part of this effect could be cyclical. Women in their middle years and older workers of both sexes are two of the groups who increase their labour supply noticeably when demand for labour is strong. But there's also a structural element to these increases, and in fact, we should have expected it. That's because these two groups are also the groups whose participation you'd expect would increase as part of population ageing. Population ageing comes from two drivers: lower fertility and increasing longevity. If women are having fewer children on average, then fewer women are out of the labour force caring for children at any one time. And this arithmetic applies even if there's no change in the cultural presumption that women, not men, should be the ones staying home to care for their children. This trend comes on top of the more general shift of women entering the workforce as social, educational, and legal barriers to female participation were removed over past decades. And thus, as you can see in the graph, female participation in middle years has increased almost everywhere, and most recently, especially in Japan. And if people are living longer, healthier lives, fewer people will be retiring due to ill health. So more people in older age groups will be able to continue working, and they will need to do so in order to fund a longer retirement. We shouldn't be surprised then that this group will also see a trend increase in their participation. And again, you see that right across the board in this graph, even in the United States. Now, it is hard to disentangle the cyclical from the trend. Still, many observers focused on the idea that with a higher proportion of workforce in older age groups that have lower average participation, total participation would fall. But except in the United States, the opposite happened, because the underlying drivers of the wave lower fertility and longer healthy lifespans necessarily also created the conditions for higher participation in some groups of the population. Now, some waves of change are initially spurred by something outside the economic system, but their effects are heavily mediated by subsequent business decisions. The best example here is probably the adoption of technology. Invention of a new technology could easily be seen as outside the economic system, because, you know, sure, research funding, property rights and other incentives no doubt influence the rate of invention. In the end, somebody has to have an idea, and that probably can't be forced. Once the idea is out there, though, adoption depends on many factors. It matters whether a technology is generally applicable, how much it costs, whether people need new or rare skills to make best use of it. Over recent decades, computer software has become an increasingly important set of tools supporting many different kinds of work. You can see the computer and internet revolutions in firms spending on software investment, culminating in a peak around the dot-com boom and Y2K rectification work, which can be thought of as bumps on top of the wave. More recently, this type of investment has again been increasing faster than the economy as a whole as firms adopt mobile, cloud, and other new technologies. Sometimes technological change is less about the invention of a newer technology and more about policy incentives as well as the subsequent iterative development that makes the technology cheaper. As the Deputy Governor pointed out a few months ago, the cost of generating renewable energy has declined significantly worldwide over the past decade. It is now cost competitive with traditional generation methods. And partly in response to this price signal, as well as to policy incentives, we are seeing a wave of private sector investment in renewable energy in Australia and elsewhere. This investment is clearly visible in the aggregate investment data, and we take this shift into account in our forecasts. The result of that investment wave is also increasingly visible in the shift to renewables in total electricity generation. Now, so far, much of the increase has been in wind and small-scale rooftop solar generation. But as renewable generation technologies continue to develop, including energy storage, this shift can be expected to continue. Other waves come wholly from inside the system, from the business decisions people make and the business models that people adopt. A change in business structure can change how the economy operates and how economic variables relate to each other. Now, a good example of this in Australia has been the increasing degree of competition in retailing, partly from the entry of large global retailers to the Australian market. It wasn't so long ago that Australia's retail landscape looked very different, with few of the global retailers that populated the shopping centres of large cities overseas. That has changed over the past decade or so, especially in groceries and clothing retail. The effect on pricing models has been profound. After a long period where retail prices tended to rise at roughly the same rate as inflation generally, for the past decade or so, these prices have been flat to falling. This is a big change in pricing behaviour for some important parts of the consumer price index. And the question of how long this shift will last has been a key issue for us as we compile our inflation forecasts. Now, markets can open up to new players right across the economy, not just in retail. As we mentioned in our most recent statement on monetary policy in August, some parts of Australia's manufacturing sector are performing strongly and seeing their exports increase quite noticeably. This upswing is most evident in scientific instruments and in medicinal and pharmaceutical products, including vitamin supplements. In some cases, this is driven by a small number of Australian firms, so you could argue that this is a lump, not a wave. But once markets open up to one player, they generally do stay open. And this is another development that we factored into our forecasts. And again, we have to grapple with the question of how long it will go on. Decisions by firms and other economic actors can also have wave effects at the regional level. Even if they wash out at the national level, they can still have big effects on some people's lives. And certainly Geelong has seen the effects of these decisions, with a number of government agencies locating here in recent years, and the opening up of some transport infrastructure better connecting the whole region to Melbourne and beyond. And both of these factors have been at work in attracting people to the Geelong and Surf Coast regions. Now, there are many lessons to draw from the existence of lumps, bumps and waves. First, lumps and bumps aren't always forecastable, except for the policy changes that are announced before they're implemented. So we can forecast the effect of the low and middle income tax offset on household disposable income or the childcare subsidy changes on inflation, but we can't predict dam collapses and cyclones in advance. So we do have to be modest about what we can do with our forecasts. Second, tracking the lumps, bumps and other temporary special factors doesn't always feel a whole lot like the economics we learned at university. But if we don't do it, we will end up missing important developments and could seriously misinterpret the aggregate data. Third, there are established techniques for looking through the noise in data. This is important for avoiding excuse-making, stripping out the inconvenient movements while leaving in the ones that line up with a story that you want to tell. We do need to look through the lumps and bumps and noise to discern the underlying trend. But if we just excluded certain movements in an ad hoc way, we could be accused of bias, or we could miss something important. So even though our policy target is specified as a medium-term average of overall CPI inflation, we use the trim mean measure in our forecasting because it strips out extremes on both the high and low sides, and it doesn't presume where the noise comes from. There are other techniques for getting at the underlying trend in a series like of inflation, and we look at those measures too, but we do tend to publish trimmed mean as the main measure that we use in forecasting. Finally, and most importantly, the real art, the value add, is in identifying and quantifying the waves. This is more like the economics that we were trained to do, but it's still hard because a lot of standard economic theory necessarily starts from a presumption that the environment is stable. Waves, by definition, are a period of transition between two different states of the world. This doesn't mean that our economic understanding is all superfluous. The standard models need not be thrown out completely. And we have to be careful to avoid seeing paradigm shifts in every wiggle of the data. But structural change permeates the economy and always will. I hope these examples have given a flavour of some of the issues and trends we grapple with as we try to understand economic developments. Our engagement with the business sector and with community groups is very important to our understanding. So as well as thanking you for your time today, I'd like to thank all of the firms and community groups we meet with. Among the lumps, bumps and waves, there are many important stories that we need to hear. Without you, it would be much harder to do so. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lucy. Lucy has kindly agreed to take some questions. So any questions from the floor, please put up your hand, but please wait for a microphone. So while you're thinking about your questions, you've got one, Jamie. There you go. After you, Jamie Benton.
Thank you. Thank you, Lucy. Perhaps a wave globally is the low interest rates that are everywhere in our major economies around the world. And I don't know about wage growth around the world, but I suspect that's quite low as well. And CPI in many, many countries around the world is also low. Mm. What's the problem with all three of them being low at the same time?
Thanks, Jamie. That's a very good question. It's not really quite the case that wages growth and CPI growth are low right around the world. There are a number of advanced economies where unemployment has gotten low enough to start pushing wages growth up. It was a lower level of unemployment to get there than a lot of people expected, but once you get there, it happens. Wages growth has picked up right around the industrialised world, more or less, other than Australia. And at least in a subset of those countries, we have also seen a bit of a pickup in inflation. Maybe not a big one, but inflation's quite close to two, has been at two and is quite close to two in the US. Some of the Scandinavian economies, the UK, a number of other advanced economies, actually inflation's more or less at target. And the sort of the where it's been sort of lower than people would have wished has been mainly sort of Europe and Japan, more so than, say, the US. It's been lower and they've been responding to downside risks, and that's why you've seen some recent easing in monetary policy stance in some of those economies. But it's not a universal that wages growth has been weak and inflation has been weak. But it is a universal that the global interest rate has come down, and the governor has talked about this publicly a number of times recently. I mean, it is, you know, kind of hard to grapple with, but it just seems that for a variety of perhaps demographic reasons, the supply of savings in the world is very high relative to the appetite to invest. And there could be a number of different moving parts driving that result. But the reality is, if you've got a lot of savings looking for an investment home, the price of those savings, the return you get on them, goes down. And that's a global phenomenon, as the governor has talked about. As an independent central bank in a country that has a floating exchange rate, we do have a fair bit of autonomy to move around the global trend in a cyclical way, but we can't fully resist that global trend. We have to sort of take the world as we find it. Is it a bad thing? I think one of the issues is it is kind of weird to have interest rates at zero and people not invest. So I think the underlying problem is the lack of appetite to invest and the willingness to take very low returns and not be compensated for risk. So there's a number of things that are a concern about that. But I think fundamentally the issue is that even with, you know, rates where they are and the cost of capital as low as it is, people just don't seem to be particularly inclined to invest enough to absorb the savings that people would like to save.
Hi, I'm Jen Cromedy from the Committee for Geelong. So I just want to thank our group for coming to Geelong and yourself coming today. It's really exciting to have people here talking about macro issues. So I was very interested to see the population growth here in Geelong on your graph. My question's more about this question around consumption and retained savings and high rates of savings and how the decisions are made by the RBA and others around certain factors that are sort of almost set in terms of decision making. My question is, we're in an environment where waste management's a huge issue, where people are really engaged around the circular economy and what are we going to do to be a more sustainable world, in effect. Yet at the same time, we're telling people we need to buy more and we need to spend more. So I know it's a bigger question than probably just the RBA, but I'm always intrigued at interest rates discussion being hinged on the idea that we need to consume more and spend more to actually have a vibrant economy, when I think we need to reset the paradigm.
I hear what you're saying, and it is a very good question. And I think fundamentally the issue is we need more income, we need more jobs, we need more employment. I mean, employment is growing very quickly, but so is the supply of labour. And so we have spare capacity in the labour market. And in order to get people in jobs, we need more growth. Now, there are several different ways you can spend to create those jobs, but in the end, a lot of that will be consumption. Some of it will be investment. And so I think that's, you know, there has actually been quite strong, up until very recently, there was quite strong growth in dwelling investment. And, you know, despite the recent falls, dwelling investment is at a high level. You know, a lot of people sort of like to think of dwellings as not being productive, but they do provide housing services. People live in them. And so that's something to think about. But, yeah, I mean, in some sense, reducing waste is about increasing productivity. You get more for what you put in because you don't have as much waste. And so, you know, I don't think any economist is going to argue with having higher productivity. But you're right. I mean, fundamentally the issue is, well, if people don't spend money, how else are we going to get people in jobs? And that's really fundamentally the issue. Thank you very much for the question.
Tim Piper from the AI Group, and thank you very much for that presentation. Just getting back to the reduction in interest rates that were this week, and obviously that's very pertinent. It's going to have an effect on the housing market, and previously the governor has made comment about his concerns there. Does the bank think that it'll make a difference with the investment profile and investment activity of businesses as well? Or because 0.25%, you know, when it's down as low as it is, it doesn't seem to make that much difference, and yet it might do the opposite and really encourage the housing market, which is of some concern. So how does the bank weigh those two or three issues up in making the decision?
Thanks for the question. Yes, the board absolutely does weigh up those issues. To answer the substantive question, actually, historically, both in Australia and in every other country, it's actually really hard to find a direct effect of interest rates on business investment. If interest rates being lowered, you know, boosts spending, boosts growth, increases jobs, that creates a better demand environment that will subsequently encourage investment. But the direct effect of interest rates on business investment is basically not evident in the data, no matter how much you torture it with econometric techniques. So really, I mean, the housing market is very interest sensitive. That's a known factor. Dwelling investment is quite interest sensitive, although there are reasons to think that maybe it might take a bit longer to come through or be not as strong a response this time around, and we've allowed for that. But we do still think, you know, so in essence, the transmission of monetary policy doesn't rely on business investment being one of the first stage responses, but you still do get channels of transmission via the exchange rate, via consumer spending decisions, by the fact that, you know, indebted households now have more dollars in their pocket, which they can choose to spend or reduce their debt and feel better about their balance sheets. And all of those channels of transmission are still in operation. Thanks.
In his remarks on Tuesday night, and I think I heard him correctly, you've got to correct me if I'm wrong, but the Governor, Phil Lowe, said that the average household has 16 months of housing repayments in the bank in terms of offset accounts and other means of savings, which tells me that we've gone in a fairly short period from a nation, and this has been a theme of the questions, a nation of spenders to a nation of savers for a whole range of factors. In your mind and the bank's mind, what are the magic ingredients for the recipe to get households to invest again? And if you make that assumption around households, you have to make a similar assumption around business, having more cash. What are the magic ingredients to get businesses to business and households to invest?
Well, thanks for that question, Innes. It's just to clarify, it's about 2.5 years of sort of accumulated buffer in offset and redraw accounts of people who have mortgages. Obviously, that doesn't apply to people who don't have mortgages. It's only the ones who do. And a reasonable fraction of people have quite new mortgages and have very small buffers, so it's not evenly distributed. But that's not really a new phenomenon. It's been growing for quite some time. And fundamentally, one of the things that is going on is that households are responding to incentives. We have variable rate interest mortgages in this country. We have an incentive because owner-occupied debt is not tax-deductible, to pay down your debt quickly. And doing that in an offset account or redraw facility is a very tax-effective way of precautionary saving, and you can still draw it back if you need to. So rather than just having a lower mortgage, having a, you know, a big redraw facility just means if something bad does happen to you. So it actually imparts a great deal of resilience. So I wouldn't say it's a change in saving behaviour. The household saving ratio is not particularly high at the moment. It's more about the tax and other incentives in the Australian system that have incentivised the building up of buffers. And, you know, with my old hat of financial stability on, I would, you know, say that that is just a really good outcome. In terms of getting things moving and getting people spending again, as we've talked about recently, it's fundamentally an income problem. Wages growth has been very constrained for a while. It's just really hard to have inflation at 2.5%, which is the middle of our target band, if you've got wages growth at more like 2. If you think that there's positive productivity growth and on average sort of 1 plus is the, sort of the average rate of productivity growth over a long period. So those sort of things don't add up. So it's just very hard to sort of, you know, avoid having low inflation when, you know, wages minus productivity is as low as it is. So fundamentally, this is an income problem. And as I mentioned, part of this, you know, a large part of that is about wages growth. Another part of it, which we've identified publicly in the past, is that actually the deductions from household income through tax have been growing quite quickly. In calendar 2018... gross household income, as reported in the national accounts, increased by about 3.5%, but the tax take increased by 10%. And it can't be bracket creep because people weren't creeping up brackets that much. So, you know, there's been a real increase in sort of compliance with tax law, and as a consequence, there's the tax density of household income has really increased. So one thing we need to see is stronger growth in gross income, more employment, more people in jobs, stronger wages growth. And the other thing is to avoid taking that kind of rate out of the growth of the income that does occur.
Lucy, thank you very much. Could you please join me in thanking Lucy Ellis?